This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Sony Pictures, All Saints, the inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett, All Saints, in theaters August 25th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. We were all recently shocked by the news that a terminally ill young girl was euthanized in Belgium, the first juvenile to be killed since that country did away with age restrictions on euthanasia 2 years ago. In Holland, children as young as 12 can be euthanized, by the way. And this is an evil and dangerous and growing movement worldwide, as evidenced by the recent passage of physician-assisted suicide in California. We in the United States will be under continued pressure to accept the lie that euthanasia is mere death with dignity. And that is why I am so heartened about a new documentary that is called The Euthanasia Deception. It exposes the shocking truth about assisted suicide. And we're going to be hearing more about it now from Alex Shadenberg, who is executive producer of The Euthanasia Deception and also executive director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition in London, Ontario. Great to have you here, Alex. So good to talk to you again. How are you?
It's great being with you. It's important information to be talking about.
Oh, for sure. You did a wonderful job on the film, by the way. I watched it, and it is so moving. And I love the tagline for the new film, too. We are all vulnerable. Explain, if you would, why everybody needs to know about the euthanasia deception and why we are all vulnerable.
Well, there's a couple of things. Like the culture is telling us, or certainly the euthanasia lobby and the death lobby is telling us that, you know, euthanasia, assisted suicide, it's all about our autonomy. It's all about our freedom. It's all about our choices. This is what we're hearing. And, you know, don't stand in the way of my choice. They're saying it's about compassion and mercy. And, oh, if you're concerned, we will have safeguards. And the euthanasia deception, what we did is we interviewed people with direct experience with euthanasia, people who have either had their family members die by euthanasia, they've been involved with the euthanasia question in different ways, or they were involved as a medical person who experienced the question of euthanasia directly. And we break down the questions and the lies, the deceptions to the culture, and we show that this is not about compassion and mercy. Certainly it's not about autonomy, and it's definitely, the safeguards definitely do not protect people who are vulnerable. And so, you know, the whole lie is that this can be done safely and we can have a little bit of death, and in fact the truth is that is not true. And so this is what was important, because, you know, the other side talks about all these stories, these terrible stories of people's health conditions, et cetera. And the fact is, you need to also hear the stories of people who have also had direct experience.
Yes.
So, you know, for instance, you know, Hank Reitsma's grandfather, Hendrik Reitsma comes from the Netherlands. His grandfather did not ask for euthanasia. His grandmother did not ask for euthanasia for her husband. What happened is that the doctor simply asked his grandmother, "Would you want your husband to be kept comfortable?" Mm. And, you know, she responded by saying, "Of course." She did not realize that what he was actually saying is, "Do you want his life to be ended?" She didn't realize that. She had no idea that that's what he was actually saying to her. And that was the end result. His life was ended intentionally. And you talk to Tom Mortier. Tom Mortier's mother died by euthanasia. And Tom is a professor in Belgium, and his depressed mother died by euthanasia. He had no idea his mother was going to die by euthanasia. He receives a phone call, and it's, contact the hospital. Your mother has died, and he's shocked. Was there a car accident? What happened to mother? She was healthy. No, she died by euthanasia. She was completely healthy, but she was depressed. Yeah. She was going through depression, and the euthanasia clinic approved her euthanasia. You know, and then you speak to Lionel Roosma. He's got a disabled daughter who's significantly disabled. And he says, well, the culture, this darkness that hangs over Belgium. We're walking through the park as a family. Our daughter Tikva is in her wheelchair. She is significantly disabled. And someone who you've never met before comes up to you and says, why did you not euthanize that girl?
Oh, awful. It's
so
awful.
This is where the culture goes. This is what it's about. It's totally changing the attitude towards whose life is worth living.
Oh, I know. And there was a disability activist, I think the woman from Not Dead Yet was in the movie, and one of the comments I believe she made was, I've never heard of any disabled person who hasn't been told at some point, oh, I'd rather die than live like you. I mean, what is that?
That's exactly the reality. So we don't understand the reality of certain human people within our human family who already judge the lives of others. Or they would say, I wouldn't want to live like you. Or you know, what they're actually saying, what's actually happening is if euthanasia were to become legal, then you have this cultural, subtle pressure upon people that their life be ended.
Right.
And it becomes a very significant thing. You know, Mark Pickup tells his story in the video. Now, he's a Canadian, but he talks about how when he, in 1985, when he first was diagnosed with MS, you know, he was a healthy young man who was athletic. He had a great job. He loved playing his guitar. He was a father, and now suddenly he loses his ability to walk. He becomes disabled within a short period of time. He says, "I became very depressed."
Of course,
if euthanasia were legal or assisted suicide were legal, you know, I would have seriously considered it. And yet he says, "Now I am a happy person." And what it is, he says, you cannot judge quality of life by how you feel today, and you cannot judge quality of life by your ability to do things.
Right.
Quality of life is most best judged by your relationship with others, and that becomes how we should be challenging each other. How do we care for others? How do we make sure that others are better included within our culture?
Yeah, I love that line and how he described his quality of life. His definition of quality has changed. It's not what society says. And this is such an important point, Alex, because society really has morphed into this quality mentality. In other words, if your life or your body isn't deemed to have sufficient quality anymore, then maybe you ought to think about taking your own life. How do you think it is that we got here? Do you think it was basically once we opened the door for abortion, then euthanasia was inevitable, or how do you see it?
Well, sadly, I'm not saying that abortion was not part of the cause, but I think that it's always been part of our human condition. We've always been like this. If you think about historically, whenever you in law give somebody, some human being, the right in law to cause the death of another human being, what you get is you have a situation from the beginning where there seems to be a tendency of human beings to judge the other, and to judge the other in such a way that you have always had a level of eugenics within the culture. I'm not saying that we can't somehow minimize that, but it's always there. It's never safe in law to give someone else the right to cause your death. It's never safe because you're assuming so much, and yet the reality is none of these decisions are made in, how would you say, on your own.
Right.
We're talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. So the first lie is this is about autonomy. Well, all the laws are written in such a way that you don't actually make the decision. Someone might ask for it. That is true. And there's many reasons why someone might ask for it. Tom Mortier's mom was depressed. Depression is a very likely factor that leads to someone feeling their life has lost value, that there is no more purpose to their life. Nonetheless, the fact is that somebody else decided that, yes, your life is not worth living, and I will end your life, and I will do that, and yes, I would agree that that is the best answer for this situation. And that's what is going on here. Somebody else is deciding. When we're talking about euthanasia, someone else actually is doing the act, whereas assisted suicide is they're providing you the means, right?
Yeah,
but
right.
You do the act yourself. But in the case of euthanasia, someone else is actually doing it. So when someone else lethally injects me, which is what's now been legalized in Canada, how is that about my freedom and autonomy? How can you prove that had anything to do with my autonomy? It's a lie.
Yeah.
It's a lie to make us feel better about it. And what is compassion? Is compassion a lethal injection, or is compassion helping those people come to a better time in their life, or to be with that person and so they can live their life with true dignity as they are going through these situations? Like, when was a lethal injection having anything to do with compassion? I'm told all the time, I'm not compassionate because I don't believe in killing people. Excuse me, I don't in any way want anyone to suffer inordinately. I have no interest in that. But at the same time, it's never been a good idea to give someone else the right law to kill you. Historically, it's just always been that way, and we're being very foolish in this time of history.
We certainly are, and there are a lot of other things I want to get to in this fantastic new documentary. It is called The Euthanasia Deception. We are all vulnerable, and it's so true. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today with Alex Schadenberg, executive producer of the film. We'll return right after this.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
I reminded you yesterday about the latest frightening example of socialized medicine, the one we experienced in the life of little Charlie Gard from the UK. This poor baby boy was not allowed to receive potentially life-saving treatment because it was simply not cost-effective. Not even the fact that the family had the money to pay for the treatment themselves made any difference. And it was simply heartbreaking to see this mother and father struggle to fight the government for their child's life. They unfortunately lost that battle. Did you know today that in the United States, we are closer to embracing that model than ever before? The disaster that is Obamacare has opened the door for it, and we must stand against it.
The Bible tells us that all life is precious, but government overreach threatens the very foundations of this belief. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org for a free resource that gives you more information about the implications of socialized medicine. That's CapitolHillBrief.org.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their healthcare. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your healthcare, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your healthcare while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you in part by Sony Pictures, All Saints. The inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett, All Saints, in theaters August 25th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today, and as we look, as I mentioned earlier, about this news of this 17-year-old girl who was euthanized in Belgium, you just shake your head and think, how evil can it get? You start to kill children. It's unbelievable, but it's going on. And there's more and more pressure throughout the world by these people who really believe in this euthanasia movement for us to accept it. We've seen it in cases like Brittany Maynard here and made a big hero in California and was very instrumental in getting that assisted suicide law passed in California. There will continue to be pressure, though, as euthanasia gains ground and more people say, well, it's death with dignity. The Euthanasia Deception, a new documentary, is out debunking these lies and these myths. Vulnerablefilm.com, the website that you can take a look at. And Alex Schadenberg is with us, executive director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Alex, one of the things you say in the film is one of the central points, I think, in this whole thing. People think that euthanasia is a good option, those who would be convinced by the arguments anyway, because you don't want to see somebody who's going to die anyway endure unbearable physical pain. But you point out that the reason people ask for death is almost never because of unbearable pain. It's because of the fear of suffering or because of the emotional distress. That changes the whole thing.
It does change the whole thing. And in fact, when you listen, when you're watching Euthanasia Deception, you'll notice that there are several physicians in the video. Dr. Benoit Busselenk is an oncologist in Belgium. Dr. Catherine Dobbs, she's a palliative care physician and also an oncologist in Belgium. They're saying exactly the same thing. People are not asking for this because they're in great physical pain. That's a rare, rare situation. And if that were the case, we can control the pain.
Right.
The question is more the social, psychological, emotional, spiritual issues that lead to the request for euthanasia. It's the belief that my life has lost value, that my life that I have no purpose for living. And there's many different reasons why someone might feel that way. But when we look at it further, and there was a study done in Oregon. So in Oregon, where assisted suicide's been in place, been incurring since 1998, there was a study done in 2008 where they asked 58 people why they had asked for assisted suicide. These people who had requested assisted suicide. And none of the 58 rated their pain as greater than 2 out of 5. None of them. Now, I'm not saying nobody experiences pain that's greater than 2 out of 5. But of the 58, none of them rated their pain as greater than 2 out of 5. Fear of future suffering was significant. Or feeling like a burden on others was significant. Or fear of loss of control was significant. But these are all social questions. And most often, this is related to depression. There's a very few what you call radical autonomists out there who say, well, you know, I've always controlled everything in my life, and I'm going to control even my death to the very end. And even then, why would you then choose euthanasia? Because you're not actually controlling your death. Somebody else is directly involved in controlling the decision-making, how it's going to be done, when it's done, and everything else. You're just simply asking for it, and then they determine whether or not you qualify. It's all about the doctor's right in law to cause your death. That's what the laws are about. Just read the definitions in the bills. It's all about them. It's not about you. This is not about your autonomy, your choice.
Yeah.
And let's be brutally honest, this is rarely about pain. But you see, that's the flag they wave.
Yes.
The reason they wave that flag is none of us want to experience pain and suffering like that. I don't want to, and I don't want you to experience it either. Nonetheless, because that's the reality of our human condition. That's what people fear the most.
Yeah, exactly right. And if it were different circumstances, for example, if somebody you knew and loved said, I think I'm going to end it all, not sick at all, but just said, I'm going to commit suicide. As a friend, much less a doctor or somebody who is a nurse, you would rush to that person and say, no, you know, you try to stop them. You know, you see these, I saw this, you might have seen this as well, Alex, but that show, there were some clips on TV about this woman who had an assisted suicide party, I believe in California, and she gathered all her friends and they had a big party. And then at the end, she rolled herself, or people helped her to the top of a mountain where she killed herself. And I said, it was complicit in my mind in every case of every friend who went to that party that instead of celebrating her death, they didn't try to stop her.
I absolutely agree that, in fact, it is complicit. In fact, it is a way of pressuring. It's a subtle pressure to have that. They have the suicide party specifically in order for the end result to be you choose your death.
Yeah.
It's most often done when someone is not quite sure. So what they do is they have those suicide parties, and it becomes a pressure. It's the same thing with Brittany Maynard. The day before she died, she put out this big, posting on her Facebook that she was actually feeling pretty good and she wasn't sure whether she was going to die on November 1st. And then suddenly, of course, on November 1st, she had to die.
Yeah.
She had to die because she had already, booked it. She had already programmed it. She had already made it there, the reality that was coming.
Yeah.
And therefore, there was far too much pressure on the multi-million-dollar campaign that became the death campaign of Brittany Maynard. The death movement made millions of dollars off her campaign to die and had to then be finished as she had said it would be. And this is the reality, the pressure we build upon ourselves. The culture is not always a loving culture. Let's be brutally honest with our reality of who we are as human beings. Let's not be saying we live in utopia, when in fact, I live in London, Ontario. As much as it's a nice city, it's not utopia, and nor is there utopia around me. The fact of it is that we're all human beings, and we all become vulnerable. And when we're vulnerable, do we need someone to say, I will give you a lethal injection? Or do we need someone to say, I will help you, I will care for you, I will be your support in this time?
Exactly right. Talk a little bit, if you would, Alex, about one of the more disturbing aspects in your film, which was the hastening of death that is becoming more common, even in palliative care. This was very disturbing. You had one woman in the film who talked about working in a nursing home and how, you know, they kind of ended up looking at these patients as, let's move this thing along. You're going to die anyway. This is terrifying. I mean, as somebody who has a mother in a nursing home, it hits home for me. But I know for millions of people who are listening, you just say, this is scary that this is actually going on, this hastening of death.
Yes, Christina Hodges is her name. She left her career in nursing. She was well-respected. She had a high-up position in a major nursing home, and she previously had worked in another hospital setting, and it became just what they did in their culture. And she didn't realize at first what they were doing was actually causing death. And she actually mentions, she talks about the one story in particular, where you have this woman who had become palliative, and then Well, then she got better. So, of course, they took her out of the palliative care ward. And then she became palliative. So they put her back in the palliative care ward. And then she got better. And so then the third time when she was starting to look like she might be a little palliative, they put her in the palliative care ward and they moved her along. They made sure that she wasn't going to, as they say, get better. They intentionally caused her death. Now, this is what they did, she said. This was just their protocol and how they did things. And it was sort of like you blindly go through, sort of like in the UK. In the UK, they had this big problem with this this thing that was called the protocol that they were using in the UK. In the end, they said thousands upon thousands of people were every year dying by the protocol that they had had for palliative care. And they ended up having this big investigation, and then they changed everything. Because people who are not dying, it is the same as euthanasia to intentionally dehydrate, to give large doses of morphine, and then dehydrate to death someone who's not dying, who's not nearing death.
Right.
And that's what Christina admits to, what they were doing. They were just simply causing death rather than caring for the person who is dying.
Right. And it speaks, though, to the broader culture and how this whole euthanasia movement is affecting the way people think about the quality of life. What I like at the end of your film is you have this remark that this marks a launch of a new global resistance movement against euthanasia. And Alex, I know you know so much about what's gone on in Belgium and in Holland and so forth, and Canada, obviously, in the United States. But why the need for a global resistance movement right now? What is so serious in the advance of the euthanasia movement that requires this right now?
Well, this is a global pressure that's going on. It's not just in the U.S. It's not just in Canada. It's not just in the Netherlands and Belgium. There's a worldwide pressure to legalize doctors killing their patients everywhere. And because of this situation, we recognize that we need each other. We need to work together. There needs to be a globalized focus. And why? For instance, for us, to go to Belgium and to talk to people who've got actual life experience with euthanasia was necessary. It's necessary because it's been going on there that there are these stories. There are people doing these things, living with this situation. You see the brokenness in the family. The one man had contacted me by email in Belgium telling me that he's become a big supporter of mine and everything. And this was just before we started filming the film. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. So we sent him an email, do you want to be part of the film? And he said, well, I'll do so, but I don't want my face to be shown. So he's the man in there that it's sort of darkened around him all the time. And how it just totally has destroyed him and his family relationship after his mother died by euthanasia. You see, and he says it's not right that the one generation is transferring the pain to the next generation because they believe that their choice was their own,
right,
when in fact we now live for the rest of our lives with the death of our mother.
Right.
In the case of Tom Mortier, the death of his depressed mother, you know, his children, himself, this is a worldwide reality. We have to understand this is what it means. If you're going to legalize killing, this is the outcome. This is where it goes. It's not like this is where it may go. This is where it goes. We're all part of the same human family.
Well, we are. And when you see one of the mentions in the film about the woman, I believe it was in Belgium, who was distraught over the death of her daughter and requested euthanasia. She wasn't even sick. She was sad. I mean, who kills a woman who's depressed over the death of her daughter? How much worse can it get than that?
Yes, that was a healthy, she was 85, but she was a healthy woman. And you know, it's interesting because the one doctor in the video refers to it when he talks about the one case that was actually gone to the prosecution service in Belgium. The only reason that case went to the prosecution service in Belgium was because it happened to be that that death was done on video because there was an Australian film crew that were doing they were doing a whole documentary on the euthanasia program in Belgium, and they ended up filming that death. So they had this film showing that she's perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong with this woman. She is elderly, but there's nothing wrong with her in any way. Her head, her mind, her body, everything's fine. But she was sad because her daughter had died a few months earlier, and she felt she had no reason to live.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, you give too much power to the doctors over life and death, and you got to be very careful with what happens in life because most doctors wouldn't want to do that.
Right.
But there are a few. There are a few who would take advantage of you in your grieving time.
Well, that's why people need to see the euthanasia deception. Vulnerablefilm.com, the website. Alex Shadenberg with us. Alex, God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you very much for having me on.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Alex. We'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Sony Pictures, All Saints, the inspiring true story of Pastor Michael Spurlock, starring John Corbett. All Saints, in theaters August 25th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com. Well, it was almost 10 years ago now that five Amish schoolgirls were killed and five others were seriously wounded when they were shot at their schoolhouse in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania. The shooter was Charlie Roberts, who also died after turning the gun on himself. But in the aftermath of the tragedy, an amazing thing happened. The shooter's mother, Terry Roberts, began to meet with the victims and their families in the Amish community and learned about the power of forgiveness. And she is now out with a book telling her story. It is called Forgiven, The Amish School Shooting, A Mother's Love, and A Story of Remarkable Grace. And Terry, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Janet, for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. You are in a very unenviable position. Obviously, as a mom, you've been through an awful lot. But I think for a lot of people, their question is, what was your son like? Who was your son? They only know about the shootings and the aftermath of the shootings, but you're his mom. Tell us a little bit about what he was like.
Well, Charlie was our oldest son, and he was a wonderful son. I was just always proud of him and any efforts that he put forth and accomplishments that he had. And he, had a wonderful wife and three children. So, growing up, he was always a quiet child. He did struggle with learning, learning disabilities. But he was a sweet, sweet, tender child. And I just loved my son.
Sure.
And, on that day when this happened, it was like, whoa, it was such a disconnect.
Oh, right. Now, you had seen him, the day before, wasn't it?
I had, yes. That they had stopped by because I had just gotten back from a mission trip to France. So they had stopped by. And, Charlie went outside with his son and played baseball and came in. And he did seem extra quiet that night. Not something that I was, anything that I looked at is like, oh, my goodness, what's the matter with Charlie? It was just, he seemed extremely quiet that night, nothing that triggered any thoughts in my mind. I mean, I never had any thoughts about Charlie that, I should be concerned about him or had never seen him act out in any irrational way.
Right. Now, did he ever seem to you to have any depression or any sort of angst of any kind along the way?
I never noticed depression in my son. I just never even thought about that with him, no. No,
right.
That's not something I ever even entered my mind that he was depressed.
Right. Now, because wasn't it true that in his suicide note, he had mentioned a miscarriage as being one of the reasons that he had gone forward with the murders? What did you know about the miscarriage prior to the shootings?
Well, it was actually their daughter was born. She was 7 months into gestation, and she was born and lived 20 minutes.
Oh, I see.
So her lungs were not developed enough, to survive. And I just remember when that happened, we had a funeral and Charlie carrying that little white casket and he looked like a ghost, He just was so sad on that day. And yet, it appeared that, he healed from that and moved forward. But I didn't, as a mother, I look back and say, oh, why didn't I check in more on that? But it wasn't one of those things, he returned to work and he seemed fine, and nothing ever manifested itself in a way that, gave us any concern.
Sure. So you didn't see anything that really alarmed you. So the day that the shootings occurred, walk us through what went on for you.
Well, I mean, it was a beautiful day, a beautiful fall day, and I was at work and I heard sirens and helicopters as I sat eating lunch on the patio with my best friend. And, as I always do when I'm driving down the street, I just issued a short prayer, Lord, be with whoever needs these responders and be with those that need the help, and just return to my conversation. But when lunch ended, I walked into my office and the phone was ringing, and it was my husband asking me to come to our son's home that day. So I immediately left a 10-minute drive, and on the way there, the newscaster had reported that the man responsible for the crime, that his name was Roy, which was an incorrect name, And so immediately my thoughts were, oh my goodness, Charlie parks his milk truck really close to the school. What if something was happening and he decided to help with a rescue? What if he was shot? What if he was killed? So there's no way, in any way, shape, or form, I was prepared for the news that I received when I pulled into my son's driveway.
Wow.
And before me was the state trooper and my husband. And I looked at the trooper. I said, is my son alive? And he said, no, ma'am. And I looked at my husband, and with these dark, sunken eyes that I'd never seen in my husband before, he said, it was Charlie. And, wow, no, this just cannot be. And yet it was true. It was our son.
Goodness, what did you do for the rest of the day? I mean, that just kind of etches itself in time. That sort of a moment is just so unexpected and so horrible. But what went on? How did you function the rest of that day?
Well, I mean, that day right after it happened, you know, in my son's yard, I fell to the ground in a fetal position, feeling like everything inside of me would be expelled. And yet, within that first day, I feel like, you know, God sent two vehicles of hope to us. And because when we got home, my husband never raised his head all day. It just hung low, and the tears he just kept wiping away with a dish towel. And as he did that, he would kept repeating, those poor people, those poor mothers, those poor fathers, those poor children, we will never be able to face our Amish neighbors again. And my husband had just retired the year before. All of our married life, he was a police officer. So, and in his retirement, what did he choose to do? But he chose to be an Amish taxi driver, which is someone that drives the Amish where they want to go when it's out of distance for their buggies to take, you know, the horse and buggy to take them.
Wow.
So, you know, in his mind, we would never be able to face our Amish neighbors again. And yet, that very first day, late in the afternoon, we got a knock on the door, and it was Henry, our Amish neighbor. And he came in and walked over to my husband, who sat at the breakfast bar, started massaging his shoulders and saying, Roberts, we love you. We want you as our neighbor. We don't hold anything against you. We forgive. And, oh, my goodness, that was repeated several times. Yeah, my husband recounted his, you know, those poor people, we'll have to leave here, you know, several times. And then Henry kept repeating himself, and eventually Chuck looked up into Henry's eyes and said, thank you, Henry. And that was the first time that I had seen my husband raise his head that day. So to me, that was just, it just jumped in my spirit saying, okay, Lord, someday we will heal from this. It will take us a very long time, but someday we will heal. So I call Henry my angel in black, because that's what he was to my husband that day. He brought hope into my husband for a future.
Wow. Now, had you been surrounded, how populous is the Amish neighborhood around you where you live? Did you have a lot of Amish neighbors?
Well, for us, the ones that we were familiar with would have been, you know, the family that my parents originally bought the ground from where we live. And, Henry was across the street, and Chris's family is next to us. So they're the ones that we saw, like they would sell their vegetables and come to our door. Or, you know, if we'd see them out on the street, you know, we would make conversation and check in on their families, you know, that kind of thing. Or Henry's kids would come down swimming at my mom's pool when she used to live next door. So we were familiar with them. You know, we were friends. We were good friends. Now, we did not know, for my husband and I, we did not know any of the families that had been involved in the schoolhouse.
Right. It was just the ones
prior
around you.
To this happening.
Right. Did you get a lot of opposite reaction from people in town, people who were not as forgiving, not as loving?
I can honestly say we were protected from that in some way, shape, or form. We did not have negative comments directly to our faces. We were just protected from that. And I believe it was because of the response of the Amish community, because that story came out right away, and it brought such a different focus to the event than what it could have been. So instead of bitterness and anger, there was this, you know, this talk of forgiveness that was overwhelming, and it was wonderful. And I think because of that, we personally did not receive any really bitter comments or
phone
calls.
Incredible. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll come back talking more with Terry Roberts about her book, Forgiven. Stay with us. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and on behalf of Janet Mefford Today and the Ministry Preborn, we'd like to thank you for helping us reach our goal of giving 300 babies a chance to live, but the need is still great. Nearly 1 in 4 pregnancies end in abortion, and there are more moms to reach and more children to save. So if you haven't had a chance to donate, there's still time left. You can sponsor 5 free ultrasounds for just $140. Simply call 855-601-BABY. 100% of your gift goes toward saving babies, and all gifts are tax deductible. That's 855-601-2229.
Do you want to experience a closer relationship with God today? Well, the good news is, God desires intimacy with you more than you could ever imagine. This is Jeannie Niger with Unshaken. If you want to grow closer to God, you simply need to think what He thinks and feel what He feels about everything. And that includes the biblical feasts found in the book of Leviticus, such as Passover, Sukkot, and Shabbat. God designed the feasts Himself, not man, and He's passionate about them. So much so that, according to Zechariah and Ezekiel, we'll be celebrating them with Jesus forever. When you share His passion by observing the feasts and studying what they reveal about God and how He sees you, you experience greater intimacy with Him. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's JeannenNigro.com/Janet.
From Affirm Films and Provident Films, who brought you War Room, comes All Saints. New pastor Michael Spurlock, his struggling congregation, and a group of refugees come together, trusting God as they plant seeds for a future that might just save them all.
Start a farm. We work together, we save the church.
All Saints, starring John Corbett, in theaters August 25th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at allsaintsmovie.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today, talking with Terry Roberts, author of Forgiven. Her son, Charlie Roberts, was the notorious shooter at the Amish schoolhouse in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, almost 10 years ago. And it was such a tragedy. But out of that tragedy came so much grace and so much forgiveness. And Terry is telling her story about that. Now, Terry, we were talking a little bit about your neighbor, Henry, who had come over right after the shooting had occurred and had comforted you, comforted your husband. But then you went on to meet with other Amish families. How did that all come about? How did you begin to meet with some of the families whose children had been shot?
Okay. Well, it would have started when we buried our son, that they arrived at the gravesite. And that was just an amazing experience, because when they came to the gravesite, it was like a healing balm for us. Here was this crescent of like 30 to 40 Amish that surrounded us at the graveyard. And they were like protecting us from the media cameras out on the road. And then the first couple that came up and greeted us that day were the parents that had lost not just one daughter, but two daughters at the hand of our son. So I say, okay, who has anything in their heart that they cannot forgive or that they choose not to forgive? So that was an amazing display of acceptance of who we were and wanting us to be a part of their lives.
Right.
And
right.
So then from there, we met at the Bart Fire Hall about 6 weeks later and all got to share our hearts and our tears together. And after that, then I talked to my husband. I said, I need for us to continue our relationship with them. I just feel like it's so important. And so in January, 4 months after, we started visiting the families, and that blossomed into very rich, deep friendships that go on to today, having picnics, visiting one another, and really being caring and concerned about our lives.
Oh, it's so incredible, because you just never hear about that sort of thing in the aftermath of something so tragic on a normal scale. But when you think of how kind they were to you, it kind of dovetails with another question that I think a lot of people had, which was, if you are to commit a crime like that, to kill people or to shoot girls, that's bad enough in and of itself. But why the Amish? Why would you go to an Amish schoolhouse and do such a thing to such peace-loving people? How did you struggle with that question?
Wow, and that is really hard to answer. And of course, the answers died with my son.
Right.
But in my mind, none of his decisions make any sense at all.
Right.
But in my mind, it's almost like, was that a choice because you knew they wouldn't retaliate in any way? Because he knew the Amish. You know, he picked up milk from their farms. But there's nothing in it that makes any sense. So I really have no answers as to why he chose the Amish, other than did he somehow know in his mind that they wouldn't hold it against his family?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know. It just doesn't. Yeah, I really do not have answers for that.
Right. It's all speculative. So you continue to meet with the Amish families. And what was going on in your own heart, Terry, when you think about what happened, when you think about what your husband and you were suffering and the rest of your family? How did you cope with this? How, you know, you're meeting with the families, but clearly you're also grieving. You lost your son. You had a lot of grief in your own right from your own tragedy. How did you deal with all that? And how did you struggle with the issue of forgiveness?
Wow, one step at a time, one day at a time. And I think just my surrender to the Lord and just saying, okay, show me what the next step is. But I remember the very first night as I lay my head on the pillow and I cried out and I said, God, this is so awful. I've never heard of a worse crime in my life. And my son is responsible for it. I can't imagine anything good ever coming from this. But if you can do anything with it, Lord, to redeem it, please do that. And so that was, you know, that was just my heart cry to the Lord, you know, just this is so devastating, so awful. I don't even know if I want to wake up tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't think I did want to wake up the next morning. It was so devastating. And yet to see what has happened, you know, because of the choice of the Amish family, it's just amazing. And it definitely helped us through. But for myself, the forgiveness, it's like, okay, it's in the news that, you know, that they forgive Charlie. Do I forgive Charlie? So, and that decision was just a few days into it, you know, when I questioned it myself, can I forgive my son for what he's done? And then it was just this like, oh my goodness, well, if I didn't, wouldn't I have the same hole in my heart that he had?
Yeah.
If I allowed bitterness or unforgiveness in me, then I would be suffering the same way that he did. So, I knew that I had to forgive. And it is a choice that we make. It's not a feeling or an emotion. The decision to forgive someone is a choice.
Right. That's right. Now, one of the little girls that you have met was this little girl who was paralyzed. Are you still meeting with her?
I am. Rosanna is now 15 years old.
Wow.
She's a beautiful young woman. But unfortunately, she still is tube-fed and in a wheelchair.
Oh.
So, you know, her greeting to me when I walk in the door is, you know, or a big smile. Mm-hmm. And when I read to her, you know, sometimes she'll laugh. And so it's just a blessing to me that this family welcomes me into their home. But, yes, I've been doing that for the last 8 years.
That's neat. What did you learn from the Amish about forgiveness? You mentioned there forgiveness is a choice. It can't just be emotions. But to a lot of people from the outside, we thought that you can understand how eventually a Christian would have to forgive and would forgive. But it seemed to come so quickly and almost easily to a lot of us who were on the outside of it. What were your thoughts on the quickness with which they seemed to embrace you and forgive?
Well, I mean, it amazed me, and yet I know that they are a very forgiving people, and I had heard of situations before with something horrific happening and them, you know, welcoming families into their lives, and I'm like, wow. So it was just, it was hard to believe, and yet it wasn't, because there's a history here of, you know, they truly live the Lord's Prayer, forgive, and you will be forgiven.
Yeah.
And so in them living that out, and I mean, what I see in the young children, you know, it is, you know, some people can say, oh, it looks too automatic, and yet it's a choice that they're making, and it's the way they've been raised in that, yes, we need to forgive if we want to be forgiven. And so they are truly living out, you know, what the Lord had given us in the Lord's Prayer.
Well, that is the neatest thing. And spending all of this time with the Amish families and with, you know, Rosanna, as you've mentioned, and the rest of the community, that had to have a big impact on your whole family, I would imagine. How did your husband and your other children, the extended family, react to all of that?
Wow, yes, that's been amazing. And, you know, for my husband, and he even works with the Amish, you know, and he still drives for them. So the acceptance there was amazing. But it has just, it helped the healing to come more quickly and to just keep moving forward. We're having that response. So, and for our sons, you know, like I have one son, I don't think I have time to tell a story, but it's in the book, but he was extremely hateful on day one toward his brother and had a complete change of heart and has even since worked on a documentary about this story. So, each of the boys were different in the way they moved forward. And no matter who needs to heal from whatever, we all heal differently. And that's why we need to allow each other to massage those relationships into what they need to be.
Absolutely.
But our sons have healed well.
Well, that is a great piece of news, and it really shows the Lord's ability and willingness to bring good out of evil, to bring healing from tragedy. What has been, if any, scripture passages that have helped you in particular? Because you do mention some in the book.
Okay. Well, my all-time scripture that just helps me is Philippians 4, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
Do not be anxious about anything, but by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God that passes all understanding will guard my heart. And I always put my hand over my heart and guard my mind in Christ Jesus. Because I really feel like when I needed my heart and my mind guarded, because I felt like that's where Satan gets in and he twists truth.
Yeah.
And I need truth in my life. And so, you know, yeah, so that has really helped me. And then the Philippians 4, 7, and 8 is whatever is good, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure. If anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think on these things.
Okay.
And the God of peace will be with you.
Well, those are great.
Those two verses at the end there are ones that I wish my son would have had in his heart, on his mind, and on his lips daily.
Absolutely. Yeah. But what a story. What an incredible story. Forgiveness. Terry Roberts' book, it's called Forgiven, The Amish School Shooting, A Mother's Love, and A Story of Remarkable Grace. Terry, thank you so much. And thank you for listening here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you at janetmefford.com.